watches her with wide liquid eyes.
I hope you don't die too soon. I also like you.
As Kanya leaves the compound, she catches sight of Jaidi, standing at the edge of the ocean watching the surf. As if sensing her gaze, he turns and smiles, before shimmering into nothingness. Another spirit, with no place to go. She wonders if Jaidi will ever manage to reincarnate, or if he will continue to haunt her. If the doctor is right, perhaps he is waiting to come back as something that will not fear the plagues, some creature that has not yet been conceived. Maybe Jaidi's only hope for reincarnation is to find new life in the husk of a wind-up body. Kanya squashes the thought. It's an evil idea. She hopes instead that Jaidi will reincarnate into some heaven where wind-ups and blister rust can never be. That even if he never achieves Nibbana, never finishes his time as a monk, never makes his way into Buddhahood, that at least he will be saved from the anguish of watching the world he so dutifully defended, stripped of its flesh by the slavering mass of nature's new successes. These wind-up creatures that seethe all around. Jaidi died. But perhaps that is the best that anyone can hope for. Perhaps if she put a spring gun in her mouth and pulled the trigger, she would be happier. Perhaps if she had no large house and no karma betrayal. Kanya shakes her head. If anything is certain, she must do her duty here. Her own soul will certainly be sent back to this world again, at best as a human being, at worst as something else, some dog or cockroach. Whatever mess she leaves behind, she will undoubtedly face it again and again and again. Her betrayals guarantee it. She must fight this battle until her karma is finally cleansed. To flee it now in suicide would be to face it in an uglier form in the future. There is no escape for such as she. Chapter 29. Despite the curfews and the white shirts, Anderson Sama seems almost reckless with his attentions. It's almost as if he is making up for something. But when Emiko repeats her concerns about Raleigh, Anderson-sama only smiles a secret smile and tells her she needn't worry. All things are in flux. My people are coming, he says. Very soon everything will be different. No more white shirts.
It sounds very beautiful.
It will be, he says. I'll be gone for a few days making arrangements. When I get back, everything will be different. And then he disappears, leaving her with the admonishment that she should not change her patterns and should not tell Raleigh anything. He gives her a key to his flat. And so it is that Emiko wakes on clean sheets in a cool room in the evening with a crank fan beating slowly overhead. She can barely remember the last time she slept without pain or fear, and she is groggy with it. The rooms are dim, lit only by the glow of the street's gaslights, flickering alive like fireflies. She is hungry, ravenous. She finds Anderson-sama's kitchen and roots through sealed bins for snacks, for crackers, for snaps, for cakes, anything. Anderson-sama has no fresh vegetables, but he has rice, and there is soy and fish sauce, and she heats water on a burner, marveling at the methane jug that he keeps unsecured. It is difficult for her to remember that she ever took such things for granted, that Gendo-sama kept her in accommodations twice as luxurious on the top floor of a Kyoto apartment with a view of Toji Temple and the slow movement of old men tending the shrine in their black robes. That long-ago time is like a dream to her. the autumn sky with its clear, breathless blue. She remembers the pleasure of watching new people children from their creche, feeding the ducks or learning a new tea ceremony with attention both total and without redemption. She remembers her own training. With a chill, she sees that she was trained to excellence, to the eternal service of a master. She remembers how Gendo-sama took her and showered her with affection, and then discarded her like a tamarind hull. It was always her destiny. It was no accident. Her eyes narrow as she stares at the pan and its boiling water, at the rice she has so perfectly measured by sight alone, without a measure cup but simply scooped with a bowl, knowing precisely how much she needed, and then unconsciously settling that rice into a perfect layer, as if it were a gravel garden, as if she were preparing to perform zazen meditation on its grains, as if she would rake and rake and rake for her life with a little bowl of rice. She lashes out. The rice bowl shatters, shards spinning in different directions, the pot of water flying, scalding jewels gleaming. Emiko stands amidst the whirlwind, watching droplets fly, rice grains suspended. All of it stopped in motion, as if grain and water are wind-ups, stuttering in flight, as she herself is forced to stumble, herky-jerky through the world, strange and surreal in the eyes of the naturals. In the eyes of the people she so desperately desires to serve. Look what service has brought you. The pot hits the wall. Rice grains skitter across marble. Water soaks everything. Tonight, she will learn the location of this new people village. The place where her own kind live and have no masters. Where new people serve only themselves. Anderson-sama may say that his people are coming, but in the end, he will always be natural, and she will always be new people, and she will always serve. She stifles the urge to clean up the rice, to make things neat for Anderson-sama when he returns. Instead, she makes herself stare at the mess and recognize that she is no longer a slave. If he wishes rice cleaned off the floor, there are others to do his dirty work. She is something else. Something different. Optimal in her own way. And if she was once a falcon tethered, Gendo-sama has done one thing that she can be grateful for. He has cut her jesses. She can fly free. It is almost too easy to slip through the darkness. Emiko bobs amid the crowds, new color bright on her lips, her eyes darkened, glinting silver hoops at her lobes. She is new people, and she moves through the crowds so smoothly that they do not know she is there. She laughs at them, laughs and slips between them. There is something suicidal ticking in her wind-up nature. She hides in the open. She does not scuttle. Fate has cupped her in its protective hands. She slips through the crowds, people jerking away, startled from the wind-up in their midst, from the bit of transgressive manufactory that has the effrontery to stain their sidewalks, as if their land were half as pristine as the islands that have ejected her. She wrinkles her nose. Even Nippon's effluent is too good for this raucous, stinking place. They simply do not recognize how she graces them. She laughs to herself and realizes when others look at her that she has laughed out loud. White shirts ahead. Flashes of them between the trundle of megadonts and handcarts. Emiko stops at the rail of a Klong bridge, looking down into the waters, waiting for the threat to pass. She sees herself in the canal's reflection with the green glow of the lamps all around, backlighting her. She feels perhaps she could become one with the water if she simply stares at the glow long enough. Become a water lady. Already is she not part of the floating world, Does she not deserve to float and slowly sink? She stifles the thought. That is the old Emiko, the one who could never teach her to fly. A man approaches and leans against the rail. She doesn't look up, watches his reflection in the water. I like to watch when the children race their boats through the canals, he says. She nods slightly, not trusting herself to speak. Is there something you see in the water, that you look so long? She shakes her head. His white uniform is tinged green. He is so close he can reach out and touch her. She wonders what his kind eyes would look like if his hands touched the furnace of her skin. You don't have to be afraid of me, he says. It's just a uniform. You haven't done anything wrong.
No,
she whispers.
I am not afraid.
That's good. A pretty girl like you shouldn't be. He pauses. Your accent is odd. When I first saw you, I thought you might be Chao Zhou. She shakes her head slightly, a jerk.
So sorry. Japanese.
With the factories? She shrugs. His eyes bore into her. She makes her head turn. Slowly, slowly, smoothly, smoothly. Not a single stutter, not a single jerk. And meet his eyes. Return his steady gaze. Older than she first thought. Middle-aged, she thinks, or not. Perhaps he is young and only worn down by the evils of his job. She stifles the urge to extend pity to him, fights her genetic need to serve him, even if he would sooner see her dismembered. Slowly, slowly, she turns her eyes back to the water. What is your name? She hesitates.
Emiko.
A nice name. Does it mean something? She shakes her head.
Nothing important.
So modest for a woman so beautiful. She shakes her head.
No, not so. I am ugly.
She breaks off. Sees him staring, realizes that she has forgotten herself. Her movements have betrayed her. His eyes are wide, surprised. She backs away from him, all pretense of humanity forgotten. His eyes harden. Hichikichi, he breathes. She smiles tightly.
It was an honest mistake.
Show me your import permits. She smiles.
Of course. I'm sure they are here, of course.
She backs away, flashbulb movements broadcasting every kink in her DNA. He reaches for her, but she pulls her arm from his grasp, a quick twist, and then she is turning away, breaking into flight, blurring into traffic as he shouts after her. Stop her! Stop! Ministry business! Stop that wind-up! Her whole essence cries to stop and give herself up, to bend to his command. It is all she can do to keep running, to push herself against the lashings of Mizumi Sensei when she dared disobey, the disapproving sting of Mizumi's tongue when she dared to object to another's desires. Emiko burns with shame as his commands echo behind her. But then, the crowds have swallowed her, and the surge of Megadon traffic is all around, and he is far too slow to discover which alley hides her as she recovers. It takes extra time to avoid the white shirts, but at the same time, it is a game. Emiko can play this game now. If she's quick and careful, and allows time between her sudden surges, she evades them easily. At speed, she marvels at the movements of her body. How startlingly fluid she becomes, as if she is finally being true to her nature. As if all the training and lashes from Izumi-sensei were designed to keep this knowledge buried. Eventually she makes Plunchit and climbs the tower. Raleigh is waiting by the bar as he always is, impatient. He glances up.
You're late.
I'm fining you for that. Emiko forces herself not to feel guilt, even as she apologizes.
So sorry, Raleigh-san.
Hurry up and get changed. You have VIP guests tonight. They're important, and they'll be here soon.
I want to ask you about the village.
What village?
She keeps her face pleasant. Did he lie about it? Was it always a lie?
The place for new people.
Still worrying about that?
He shakes his head.
I told you. Earn up and I'll make sure you get there if that's what you want.
He waves her toward the dressing rooms.
Now, go get changed.
Emiko starts to press again, then simply nods.
Afterward.
When he is drunk. When he is pliable, she will pry the information from him. In the dressing room, Kanika is already pulling on her performance clothes. She makes a face at Emiko but doesn't say anything as Emiko changes and then goes out to get her first glass of ice for the evening. She drinks carefully, savoring the coolness and sense of well-being that overcomes her even in the swelter of the tower. Out beyond the roped-off windows, the city glows. From a height, it is beautiful. Without natural people in it, she thinks that she could even enjoy it here. She drinks more water. A rustle of warning and surprise. Women drop to their knees and press their foreheads to the ground in a crowd. Emiko joins them. The man is back again. The hard man. The one who came with Anderson-sama before. She searches for signs of Anderson-sama, hoping that he will be here too, but there is no sign of him. The Somdet Chao Phraya and his friends are already flushed and drunk as they come through the doors. Raleigh rushes to them and ushers them into his VIP room. Kanika slips up behind her.
Finish your water, Hichikichi.
You've got work to do.
Emiko stifles the urge to snap at the girl. It would be insane to do so. But she looks at Kanika and prays that when she knows the village's location, that she will have an opportunity to pay the woman back for all the abuse she has delivered. The VIP room is crowded with men. There are windows to the outside, but with the door closed, there is little circulation. And the act is worse than when Emiko is on the stage. Normally, there are patterns to Kanika's abuse. Here, though, Kanika leads her around, introducing her to the men, encouraging them to touch her and feel the heat of her skin, saying things like, "You like her? You think she's a nasty dog? Watch. You'll see a nasty one tonight." The powerful one and his bodyguards and his friends are all laughing and making jokes at the sight of her, at the feel of her as they pinch her ass and tug at her breasts. Run their fingers up between her thighs, all of them a little nervous at this novelty of entertainment. Kanika points to the table.
Up!
Emiko climbs awkwardly onto the gleaming black surface. Kanika snaps at her, making her walk, making her bow. Makes her totter back and forth in her strange wind-up way, while liquor flows and more girls come in and sit with the men and laugh and make jokes, and all the while Emiko is shown off. And then, as it must be, Kanika takes her. She forces Emiko down on the table. The men gather around as Kanika begins her abuse. Slowly it builds, first playing at her nipples, then sliding the jadeite cock between her legs, encouraging the reactions that have been designed into her and which she cannot control, no matter how much her soul fights against it. The men cheer at Emiko's degradation, encouraging escalation, and Kanika, flushed with excitement, begins to devise new tortures. She squats over Emiko, parts the cheeks of her ass, and encourages Emiko to plumb her depths. The men laugh as Emiko obeys and Kanika narrates.
Ah, yes. I feel her tongue now.
Then,
do you like it with your tongue there, dirty wind-up?
To the men,
she likes it.
All these dirty wind-ups like it.
More laughter.
More, nasty girl.
More!
And then she is pressing down, smothering her, encouraging Emiko to redouble her efforts as her humiliation mounts, encouraging her to work harder to please. Kanika's hand joins Emiko's tongue, playing, taking pleasure from Emiko's subservience. Emiko hears Kanika speaking again.
You want to see her? Go ahead.
Hands on Emiko's thighs, pushing them apart so that she is completely exposed. Fingers play at her folds, penetrate her. Kanika laughs.
You want to fuck her? Fuck the wind-up girl?
Here.
Give me her legs.
Her hands close on Emiko's ankles, pull them up, exposing her completely.
No.
Emiko whispers, but Kanika is implacable. She pries Emiko's legs wide.
Be a good little Hichikichi.
Kanika settles herself again over Emiko, narrating her degradation to the assembled men.
She'll eat anything you put in her mouth,
she says, and the men are laughing. And then Kanika's pressing down hard on Emiko's face, and Emiko can't see anymore, can only hear as Kanika calls her a slut and a dog and a nasty wind-up toy. Calls her no better than a dildo. And then there is silence. Emiko tries to move, but Kanika keeps her pinned, muffled from the world.
Stay there,
Kanika says. Then,
no,
use this.
Emiko feels men taking her arms, pinning her down, fingers prod her, invade her, slide in.
Oil it,
Kanika whispers, excitement in her voice. Her hands tighten on Emiko's ankles. Wetness at her anus, slick, and then a pressure. Cold pressure. Emiko moans a protest. The pressure lets up for a moment, but then Kanika says,
you call yourselves men? Fuck her! Look how she jerks! Look at her arms and legs when you push! Make her do her Hichikichi dance!
And then the pressure comes back, and the men are holding her down more tightly, and she can't get up, and the cold thing presses again against her ass, penetrates her, spreads her wide, splits her open, fills her, and she is crying out. Kanika laughs.
That's right, wind up. Earn your keep.
You can get up when you make me come.
And then Emiko is licking again, slobbering and lapping like a dog. Desperate. As the champagne bottle penetrates her again, as it withdraws and shoves deep into her, burning. The men all laugh.
Look at how she moves.
Tears jewel in her eyes. Kanika encourages her to greater effort, and the falcon, if there is any falcon in Emiko at all, if it ever existed, is a dead thing, dangling. Not meant to live or fly or escape. Meant to do nothing but submit. Emiko learns her place once again. All night long, Kanika teaches the merits of obedience, and Emiko begs to obey and stop the pain and violation, begs to serve, to do anything at all. Anything at all to let the wind-up live just a little longer, and Kanika laughs and laughs. By the time Kanika's done with her, it is late. Emiko sits against a wall, exhausted and broken. Her mascara has run. Inside, she is dead. Better to be dead than a wind-up, she thinks. She watches dully as a man starts to mop the club. At the other end of the bar, Raleigh drinks his whiskey and laughs. The man with the mop slowly approaches. Emiko wonders if he will try to mop her away with the rest of the filth. If he will take her out and throw her into one of the trash piles. Leave her for the Dung Lord's collection. She can simply lie there and let them mulch her. Thrown away as Gendo-sama should have discarded her. She is trash. Emiko understands this now. The man pushes his rag mop around her.
"Why don't you throw me away?" she croaks.
The man looks at her uncertainly, then turns his eyes to his work. Keeps mopping. She says it again.
"Answer me," she shouts. "Why don't you throw me away?"
Her words echo in the open room. Raleigh glances up and frowns. She realizes that she has been speaking in Japanese. She says it again in Thai.
"Throw me away, why not? I am trash too.
Throw me away."
The mopping man flinches and draws back, smiling uncertainly. Raleigh approaches, kneels down beside her.
"Emiko, get up.
You're frightening my cleaning guy."
Emiko makes a face.
"I don't care."
"Sure you do."
He nods toward the door to the private room, where the men are still reclining, drinking and talking after their abuse of her.
"I've got a bonus for you. Those guys tip well."
Emiko looks up at him.
"They tip Kanika too?"
Raleigh studies her.
"It's not your business."
"They tip her triple? Give me 50 baht.
His eyes narrow.
"Don't."
"Or what? Or you throw Emiko into a methane composter? Dump me with the white shirts?"
"Don't push me. You don't want to piss me off."
He stands up.
"Come get your money when you're done feeling sorry for yourself."
Emiko watches dully as he stalks back to his bar stool. Gets himself a drink. He glances back at her, makes a comment to Daing, who smiles dutifully and pours water with ice. Raleigh waves the water at her. Sets it on top of a purple sheaf of bot. He goes back to his drinking, seeming to ignore her staring.
What happens to wind-up girls who are broken? She never knew a wind-up girl who died. Sometimes an old patron did, but the wind-up girl lived. Her girlfriends lived. They lasted longer. Something she never asked Mizumi-sensei. Emiko hobbles to the bar, stumbles, leans against it, drinks the ice. Raleigh shoves the money over. She finishes the ice water, swallows the cubes, feels their cold seeping into her core. "Have you asked yet?"
"About what?"
He's playing solitaire on the bar.
"Going north."
He glances up at her. then flips another set of cards. He's quiet for a second. That's tough work. Not something you set up in a day.
Have you asked?
He glances at her. Yeah, I asked. And no one's going anywhere while the white shirts are pissed off about the Jaidee massacre. I'll let you know when the situation changes.
I want to go north.
You already told me. Earn up and it will happen.
I earn plenty. I want to go now.
Raleigh's slap comes fast, but she sees it coming. It is fast for him, but not for her. She watches his hand proceed toward her face with a sort of servile gratitude that she used to feel when Gendo-sama took her to dinner at a fancy restaurant. Her cheek stings and then floods with puffy numbness. She touches it with her fingers, savoring the wound. Raleigh looks at her coldly. You'll go when it's damn well convenient. Emiko bows her head slightly, allowing the well-deserved lesson to filter into her core.
You aren't going to help me, are you?
Raleigh shrugs, goes back to his cards.
Does it even exist?
She asks. Raleigh glances over at her. Sure. If it makes you happy, it's there. If you keep hassling me about it, it doesn't. Now get out of my face. The falcon dangles dead. She is dead. Mulch for composters. Meat for the city. Rot for gaslights. Emiko stares at Raleigh. The falcon lies dead. And then she thinks that some things are worse than dying. Some things can never be born. Her fist is very fast. Raleigh-san's throat is soft. The old man topples, hands flying to his throat, eyes wide with shock. It is all slow motion. Dying, turning at the sound of the stool clattering to the floor. Raleigh sprawling, his mouth working, trying to suck air. The cleaning man dropping his mop. Noi and sighing at the other side of the bar with their men waiting to escort them home, all of them turning toward the sound, and every one of them is slow. By the time Raleigh hits the floor, Emiko is already bolting across the room toward the VIP room and the man who hurt her most. The man who sits and laughs with his friends and thinks nothing of the pain he inflicts. She slams into the door. Men look up with surprise. Heads turn, mouths open to cry out. The bodyguards are reaching for their spring guns, but all of them are moving too slow. None of them are new people. Chapter 30. Pai crawls up beside Kanya, stares down at the shadow village below. That's it. Kanya nods and glances back at the rest of her squad, who have spread out to cover the other approaches to the shrimp farms, where they breed bitter water-resistant prawns for the Krung Thep fish markets. The houses are all on bamboo rafts, currently grounded, but when the floods come, the houses will float, rising as water and silt rushes across the paddy and ponds. Her own family on the Mekong used something similar long years ago, before General Pracha came.
It was a good lead,
she murmurs. Ratana had been almost ecstatic. A link, a clue, fish mites between the third body's toes. And if fish mites, then shrimp farms. And if shrimp farms, then the only ones that would have sent a worker into Bangkok. And that meant shrimp farms that had experienced a die-off. Which led her to this Tonbury half-floating settlement with all of her men at the edge of the embankment, ready to raid in the darkness. Down below, a few candles flicker inside the bamboo houses. A dog barks. They're all wearing the containment suits. Ratana insisted that the likelihood of a jump was slender and yet still a worry. A mosquito whines in Kanya's ear. She slaps it away and draws her containment suit's hood tight. Starts to sweat in earnest. The sound of laughter carries across the fish ponds. A family, all together in the warmth of their hut. Even now, with all their hardship, people still can laugh. Not Kanya, though. Something in her is broken, it seems. Jaidi always insisted that the kingdom was a happy country. That old story about the land of smiles. But Kanya cannot think of a time when she has seen smiles as wide as those in museum photos from before the contraction. She sometimes wonders if those people in the photos were acting. If perhaps the National Gallery is intended to depress her. Or if it is really true that at one point people smiled so totally, so fearlessly. Kanya pulls her mask over her face.
Send them in.
Pai signals the men, and then her troops are all up and over the edges, coming down on the village, surrounding it as they always do before the burning begins. When they came to her own village, the white shirts appeared between two huts in the space of a minute, flares hissing and sparking in their hands. This is different. No blaring megaphones. No officers splashing through ankle-deep waters, dragging screaming people away from their houses as bamboo and weather all burst orange and alive with flame. General Pracha wants it quiet. As he signed the quarantine waivers, he said, Jaidi would have turned this into an emergency. But we don't have the resources to stir the cobra nest with trade and also handle this. It could even be used against us. Deal with this quietly.
Of course. Quietly.
The dog starts barking madly. It's joined by others as they approach. A few villagers come out on their porches, peer out into the darkness, catch the gleam of white in the night. They shout warnings to their families as Kanya's white shirts break into a run. Jaidi kneels beside her, watching the action. Pracha talks about me as if I were some sort of a megadont trampling rice shoots, he says. Kanya ignores him, but Jaidi doesn't shut up. You should have seen him when we were both cadets, he says. He would piss his pants when we went out into the field. Kanya glances over at Jaidi.
Stop. Just because you are dead doesn't mean that you should heap disrespect upon him.
Her men's shake-light LEDs blaze alive, illuminating the village in a bitter glare. Families are dashing about like chickens trying to hide food and animals. Someone tries to dash past the cordon, splashing through the water, diving into a pond and flailing for the other side, where more of Kanya's net appears. The man treads water in the center of the muddy shrimp hole, trapped. Jaidi asks, How can you call him your leader, when we both know where your true loyalties lie?
Shut up.
Is it hard being a horse ridden by two men at once? Both of them riding you like,
Shut up!
Pai startles.
What is it?
Sorry.
Kanya shakes her head.
My fault. I was thinking.
Pai nods down at the villagers.
It looks like they're ready for you.
Kanya gets to her feet, and she and Pai and Jaidi, uninvited but smiling and pleased with himself, all descend. She has a photo of the dead man. A black and white thing developed in the lab with fumbling dark fingers. She shows it to the farmers, under the beam of her shake-light LEDs, shining it from the photo to their eyes, trying to catch them in a flinch of recognition. With some people, a white uniform opens doors. But with fish farmers, it is always a problem. She knows them well. Reads the calluses on their hands, smells the stink of their successes and failures in the reek of the ponds. She sees herself through their eyes, and knows she might as well be an enforcer from a calorie company, hunting for signs of a gene hack. Still the charade continues, all of them shaking their heads, Kanya shining her light into each one's eyes. One by one, they look away. Finally, she finds a man and waves the picture in front of him.
Do you know him? Won't his relatives be looking for him?
The man looks at the picture and then at Kanya's uniform.
He doesn't have any relatives.
Kanya jerks with surprise.
You know him. Who was he?
He's dead then.
Doesn't he look dead?
They both study the bloodless photo, the ravaged face.
I told him there were better things than factory jobs. He didn't listen.
You say he worked in the city?
That's right.
Do you know where?
He shakes his head.
Where did he live?
The man points toward a black shadow stilt house. Kanya waves at her men.
Quarantine that hut!
She tightens her mask and enters, sweeping her light around the space. It's gloomy, broken and strange and empty. Dust gleams in her beam. Knowing that the owner is already dead gives her a sense of foreboding. The man's spirit might be here. His hungry ghost lurking and angry that he is still in this world, that he has been sickened, that he may have been murdered. She fingers the man's few effects and wanders around the place. Nothing. She steps back outside. Off in the distance, the city rises, haloed in green, the place the dead man ran to when fish farming proved untenable. She goes back to the man.
You're sure you don't know anything about where he worked?
The man shakes his head.
Nothing. Not a name. Anything.
She tries not to let her desperation show. He shakes his head again. She turns in frustration and surveys the village blackness. Crickets chirp. Ivory beetles creak steadily. They're in the right place. She's so close. Where is this factory? Gibusen was right.
She should just burn the entire factory district.
In the old days, when the white shirts were strong, it would have been easy.
You want to burn now?
Jidey snickers beside her.
Now you see my side.
She ignores his jab. Not far away, a young girl is watching her intently. When Kanya catches her staring, she looks away. Kanya touches Pai on the shoulder.
That one.
The girl.
He's surprised. Kanya's already walking, closing on her. The girl looks as if she will bolt. Kanya kneels, still a good distance away, beckons her over.
You. What's your name?
The girl is obviously torn. She wants to flee, but Kanya has an authority that cannot be denied.
Come over here. Tell me your name.
She beckons again, and this time the girl allows herself to be reeled close.
My.
The girl whispers. Kanya holds up the photo.
You know where this man worked, don't you?
Mai shakes her head, but Kanya knows the girl is lying. Children are terrible liars. Kanya had been a terrible liar. When the white shirts questioned where her family was hiding their carp breeding stock, she had told them south, and they had gone north, with knowing adult smiles. She offers the photo to the girl.
You understand how dangerous this is, yes?
The girl hesitates.
Will you burn the village?
Kanya tries to keep the flood of reaction off her face.
Of course not.
She smiles again, speaks soothingly.
Don't worry, Mai. I know what it is to fear. I grew up in a village like this. I know how hard it is. But you must help me find the source of the sickness, or more will die. I was told not to tell, and it is good for us to respect our patrons.
Kanya pauses.
But we all owe loyalty to Her Royal Majesty the Queen, and she wishes that we all be safe.
The Queen would want you to help us.
Mai hesitates, then says, Three others worked at the factory.
Kanya leans forward, trying to hide her eagerness.
Which one?
Mai hesitates. Kanya leans close.
How many P will blame you?
If you allow them to die before their karma allots their passing. Still, Mai hesitates. Pai says, If we break her fingers, she will tell us. The girl looks frightened, but Kanya holds out a soothing hand.
Don't worry. He won't do anything. He is a tiger, but I have his leash. Please, just help us save the city. You can help us save Krung Thep.
The girl looks away toward the crumbling glow of Bangkok across the waters.
The factory is closed now. Closed by you. That's very good, then.
But we must make sure the disease doesn't go any further.
What is the name of the factory?
The answer comes unwillingly.
Spring Life.
Kanya frowns, trying to remember the name.
A kink spring company?
One of the Chao Zhou?
Mai shakes her head.
Farang. Very rich Farang.
Kanya settles beside her.
Tell me more.
Chapter 31. Anderson finds Emiko huddled outside his door, and all at once, a good night becomes an uncertain one. For the last several days, he has worked frantically to prepare the invasion, all of it crippled by the fact that he never expected to be cut off from his own factory. His own piss-poor planning forced him to waste extra days scouting a safe route back into the Spring Life facility without being caught by the plethora of Whiteshirt patrols that cordoned the manufacturing district. If it hadn't been for the discovery of Hak Sung's escape route, he might still have been lurking around the back alleys, wishing for an access method. As it was, Anderson slipped in through the shutters of the Spring Life offices with a blackened face and grapple slung over his shoulder, while giving thanks to a crazy old man who just days before had robbed the company's entire payroll. The factory had reeked. The algae baths had all gone to rot. But not a thing moved in the gloom, and for that, he was grateful. If the white shirts had posted guards within... Anderson held a hand over his mouth as he slipped down in the main hall and then down along the manufacturing lines. The stink of rot and megadont dung thickened. Under the shadow of algae racks and the loom of the cutting presses, he examined the floor. This close to the algae tanks, the stink was horrific, as if a cow had died and rotted. The end-stage reek of Yates's optimistic plan for a new energy future. Anderson knelt and pushed away desiccated algae strands from around one of the drains. He felt along the edges seeking purchase. Lifted. the iron grate came up with a squeal. As quietly as he could, Anderson rolled the heavy grate away and set it with a clank on concrete. He lay down on the floor, prayed he wouldn't surprise a snake or scorpion, and plunged his arm down the hole. His fingers scrabbled in the darkness, questing, straining deeper into moist blackness. For a moment he feared it had slipped loose, had floated down the drain and on through the sewers to King Rama's groundwater pumps. But then his fingers touched oilskin. He peeled it from the drain wall, drew it out, smiling. A code book. For contingencies that he never seriously believed would come to pass. In the blackness of the offices, he dialed numbers and brought operators alert in Burma and India, sent secretaries scurrying for code strings unused since Finland. 2 days later, he stood on the floating island of Koh Angret, arranging the last details with strike team leaders in the Agrigen compound. The weaponry would arrive within days. The invasion teams were assembling, and the money had already been shipped across. The gold and jade that would help generals change their loyalties and turn on their old friend, General Pracha. But now, with all the preparations completed, he returns to the city to find Emiko huddled at his door, miserable and covered with blood. As soon as she sees him, she lunges into his arms, sobbing. "What are you doing here?" he whispers. Cradling her against him, he unlocks the door and urges her inside. Her skin burns. The blood is everywhere. Slashes mark her face and scar her arms. He shuts the door quickly. "What happened to you?" He pries her off him, tries to inspect her. She's a furnace of blood, but the wounds on her face and arms don't account for the sticky spattering that coats her. "Whose blood is this?" She shakes her head, begins sobbing again. "Let's get you cleaned up." He leads her into the bath, turns on cool water spray, puts her under it. She's shivering now, her eyes fever bright and panicked as she looks around. She looks half mad. He tries to peel off her half jacket to get rid of the bloody clothing, but her face twists, enraged. "No!" She slashes at him with her hand and he jerks back, touching his cheek. "What the hell?" He stares at her shocked. Christ, she was fast. He's hurting. His hand comes away bloody. "What the hell's wrong with you?" The panicked animal flicker leaves her eyes. She stares at him blankly, and then seems to recover herself, becomes human.
"I am sorry," she whispers. "So sorry."
She collapses, curls into a ball under the water.
"So sorry. So sorry."
She lapses into Japanese. Anderson squats down beside her, his own clothing becoming soaked in the spray. "Don't worry about it." He speaks gently. "Why don't you get out of those clothes? We'll get you something else, okay? Can you do that?" She nods dully, peels off her jacket, unwraps her pasin, huddles nude in the cool water. He leaves her in the spray, takes her bloody clothes and bundles them into a sheet and carries them down the stair, out into the darkness. People are all around. He ignores them, walking quickly into the shadows, carrying the clothes until he reaches a klong, tosses the bloody garments into the water, where snakehead fish and body carp will consume them with an obsessive determination. The water roils, splashing as they tear at the blood food scent. By the time he's back in his apartment, Emiko is out of the shower, her black hair clinging to her face, a small frightened creature. He goes to his medicine supplies, pours alcohol on the rubs, rubs antivirals in after. She doesn't cry out. Her nails are broken and ravaged. Bruises are blooming all across her body. But for all the blood she arrived with, she seems miraculously little damaged. What happened? He asks gently. She huddles against him.
I'm alone, she whispers. There is no place for new people.
Her shaking increases. He pulls her to him, feeling the burning heat through her skin. It's all right. Everything will change soon. It will be different. She shakes her head.
No. I do not think so.
A moment later, she's asleep, breathing steadily, her body finally releasing its tension into unconsciousness. Anderson wakes with a start. The crank fan has stopped, run out of jewels. He's covered with sweat. Beside him, Emiko moans and thrashes. A furnace. He rolls away and sits up. A slight breeze from the sea runs through the apartment. A relief. He stares out through mosquito nets to the blackness of the city. All the methane has been shut off for the night. Off in the distance, he can see a few glimmers in the floating sea communities of Tomburi, where they farm fish and float from one gene hack to the next in a perpetual seeking of survival. Someone pounds on his door, hammering insistently. Emiko's eyes snap open. She sits up.
What is it?
Someone's at the door. He starts to climb out of bed, but she grabs him, ragged nails digging into his arm.
Don't open it!
She whispers. Her skin is pale in the moonlight, her eyes wide and frightened.
Please!
The banging on his door increases. Thudding. Insistent. Why not? She pauses.
It will be white shirts.
What?
Anderson's heart skips over.
They followed you here? Why? What happened to you?
She shakes her head miserably. He stares at her, wondering what sort of animal has invaded his life. What happened tonight?
Really?
She doesn't answer. Her eyes remain locked on the door as the thumping continues. Anderson climbs out of bed and hurries to the door, shouts,
Just a second! I'm getting dressed! Anderson!
The voice from the far side of the door is Carlyle's.
Open up! It's important!
Anderson turns and looks pointedly at Emiko.
It's not white shirts. Now hide.
No.
For a moment, relief floods Emiko's features, but it disappears almost as quickly. She shakes her head.
You are mistaken.
Anderson glares at her.
Was it white shirts that you tangled with? Is that where you got those cuts?
She shakes her head miserably but says nothing, just huddles in a small defensive ball.
Jesus and Noah.
Anderson goes and pulls clothes out of his closet, tosses them at her, gifts that he bought her as tokens of his intoxication.
You might be ready to go public, but I'm not ready to be ruined. Get dressed, hide in my closet.
She shakes her head again. Anderson tries to control his voice to speak reasonably. It's as though he's talking to a block of wood. He kneels and takes her chin in his hands, turns her face to him.
It's one of my business associates. It's not about you, but I still need you to hide until he goes away. Do you understand? You just need to hide for a little while. I want you to hide until he's gone. I don't want him to see us together. It might give him leverage.
Slowly her eyes focus. The look of hypnotized fatalism fades.